the perspective that there are other things about prisoners that are worth covering. And I think that's made a big difference. But, you know, I also think that there's a lot of prisoners who've been more willing to speak to me because they know that I know that. They know that I come from a starting point of seeing them as human.
Finally, Kerry, dentures. We have 1 minute. Why are dentures so important?
Well, I mean, I think that just it's a body part. Like on a base level, this is a body part that many prisons, you know, were not giving to prisoners. And having them can be so important in terms of confidence and, you know, just feeling like you're being treated like a person, but also in terms of reentry and, you know, coming out and looking as employable as possible.
And so explain what you did.
In Texas prisons, they've been routinely denying dentures to toothless prisoners. They would take the food and put it in a blender, puree it, and, you know, just pour it in a cup. And I investigated this for almost a year and wrote a story about it. And afterwards, the Texas prison system bought a 3D printer to be able to start 3D printing dentures for prisoners.
Well, Kerry Blakinger, this book is astounding. Kerry is an investigative reporter in Texas for the Marshall Project. Her column is called Inside Out, that she does with NBC News and Marshall. Her new memoir out today, Corrections in Ink. We will continue our conversation in a part two at democracynow.org. We'll also link to her columns online. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Faust, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warren, Camille Baker, Tarina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Astudio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the second Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KABU Community Radio is looking for a full-charge bookkeeper. Do you have accounting and administrative experience? Do you enjoy working in a highly collaborative team environment? Are you looking for a workplace with a mission? Or do you know someone who is? Go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the full-charge bookkeeper and the qualifications we are looking for. To apply, please email your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org by Sunday, June 12th at midnight. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KABU Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. KABU's financial health is our focus. Help us foster it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a Portland auditor says the Joint Office of Homeless Services wasted money on a dangerous, pest-ridden housing complex for veterans. The family of Andrew Brown Jr., a black man killed by police in North Carolina, is awarded $3 million. And Louisiana becomes the 18th state to enact a transgender athlete ban. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, June 7th, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Oregon on Monday reported 320 patients are hospitalized with a positive coronavirus test result. That's already above projections by Oregon Health and Science University, which forecast a peak of 313 hospitalizations on June 14th. With many people who have already had COVID getting reinfected, experts are saying Oregon is in its seventh wave of the virus. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Oregon is in its seventh wave of COVID-19 infections. People who previously made it through the pandemic without getting COVID are becoming infected, and people who've already had it are getting it again and again. Most of us do have some antibodies from vaccination or previous infection, and the Omicron variant is less virulent than Delta was. While that means we are less likely to be hospitalized or die from infection, we are still seeing significant spread of the disease. At the peak of the Delta wave last summer, there were 197 COVID-19 patients on life support in Oregon. Last week, there were fewer than 10. However, the number of reported cases is way up, close to the peak during the Delta wave last summer. Experts do hope we may be approaching the limit of how much more contagious the coronavirus can get. Each dominant variant of COVID-19 has been more transmissible than the one it replaced. The Omicron variants circulating now are infecting almost 6 times more people than the original COVID strain did. This means coronavirus is one of the most contagious viruses ever seen, on par with chickenpox, but not quite as bad as measles. But physical limits will ultimately keep things in check, like how many people we can come in contact with while infectious, or how much we can actually sneeze. We also know that current variants are better at reinfecting us. Some people are getting COVID 3 and even 4 times. The ability to cause repeat infections relatively frequently is a trait COVID appears to share with the 4 viruses that cause the common cold. People are reinfected with cold viruses about once every 30 months, with evidence that some people can experience multiple infections from the same cold virus within 6 months or fewer. A similar pattern may emerge with COVID-19, where people get short-term immunity from infection or vaccination, but a vaccine that confers 5-year immunity is simply not going to happen. Christian Anderson, a virologist at the Scripps Research Institute in San Diego, said, quote, "If we manage it the way that we manage it now, then most people will get infected with it at least a couple of times a year," end quote. We also know, while vaccination and prior infection won't completely protect you from COVID-19, you do retain some antibodies that can mount at least a partial response to future infections. But long-term antibody protection may wane over time, and reinfections are still causing relatively serious symptoms for many people. Finally, the vaccine most of us have received was formulated to protect against the first COVID-19 virus we saw. It's not a great fit for the Omicron subvariants. 2 companies, Pfizer and Moderna, are trying to develop an Omicron variant vaccine, but those efforts are moving slowly. It's not scientifically difficult, but vaccine makers need to be sure that the public is willing to get an updated version of the COVID-19 vaccine to make it worth investing in. Nonetheless, Bill Messer, a viral expert at OHSU, says, quote, "If you haven't gotten a booster, do it now," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Portland City Auditor says the Joint Office of Homeless Services has wasted money on a dangerous housing complex for previously unhoused veterans. An investigation says the agency moved too slowly and should have kept a closer eye on the groups with which they contracted to run the apartments. The investigation added that the Joint Office of Homeless Services bears most of the blame for letting veterans live for over a year in moldy, pest-ridden, and expensive housing units. The auditor's investigation began last year after a tip to the city's fraud hotline alleged that the Joint Office had been wasting money by continuing to pay to house veterans in Sandy Studios, a 32-unit complex clearly unfit for human habitation. The Joint Office oversees homeless services across Multnomah County as part of a partnership between the county and the Portland City government. After investigating, auditors concluded the agency should have stepped in much more quickly to either fix the poor conditions or move residents out. Instead, according to the report, the agency spent over $850,000 to house the veterans before the city condemned the property last year. Veterans said problems with the small, kitchenless studio apartments had been obvious for years, but their complaints and maintenance requests were largely ignored. Finally, in January of 2021, a ceiling collapsed on a resident and his girlfriend, revealing large patches of black mold. Soon after, city inspectors condemned the building. The closure implicated a host of agencies in charge of caring for and housing the city's most vulnerable residents, including Do Good Multnomah, a nonprofit that serves unhoused veterans, property manager Home First Development, and local housing authority Home Forward. In response to the investigation, interim joint office head Shannon Singleton said she felt the auditor's concerns were overblown. Singleton added that the report failed to take into account the pandemic, which exacerbated the mental health issues of people living in the units and made it harder to complete property repairs, and ignored the fact that the agency had been trying to remove residents from the buildings since August of 2020. Singleton added that the agency has already taken several steps to prevent another similar situation, including hiring more people to help with the upkeep of facilities. A digital tool used to predict which families to investigate in child abuse and neglect cases will no longer be used in Oregon. This kind of technology has shown to be discriminatory in the past. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Child welfare services in Oregon will no longer use an algorithm that helps social workers decide which families to investigate. The Oregon Department of Human Services made the announcement after the Associated Press investigated a discriminatory algorithm used in Pennsylvania that inspired the state to use a similar tool. In discontinuing the technology, Oregon officials cited their desire to reduce disparities when determining which families should be investigated for abuse or neglect. Leah Holland is based in Portland with the digital rights group Fight for the Future.
The way that they work and have applied to communities of color throughout this country has been incredibly harmful and has really shown that these algorithms need much more scrutiny before they are being used in these life-altering decisions that our government and institutions are making.
Holland says algorithms often are trained on racially biased data, making their results discriminatory toward people of color. She says the technology has been used in schools and for predictive policing models. The Department of Human Services says it will stop using the algorithm at the end of June. Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden has been among the loudest critics of this kind of technology and is the sponsor of a bill to bring more transparency and oversight to the sector. Holland says federal data privacy protections would offer more safety on the use of data collected from our daily lives.
Congress could take and should take drastic action to rein in these sort of abuses and the data that these algorithms are using to discriminate against us in the first place.
Holland believes the country should take a step back and evaluate how they're using and trusting algorithmic technology, especially given the consequences.
Children of color aren't guinea pigs for these big tech companies to test out their new software on.
I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
Louisiana became the 18th state to bar transgender women and girls from playing on female sports teams on Monday, after the state's Democratic governor chose not to veto or approve the bill. Both chambers of the Republican-controlled legislature passed the bill last month. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards said Monday that he would not sign the bill, but he also would not veto it. Under Louisiana law, any bill passed by the end of the legislative session becomes law if the governor does not take action. The bill, called the Fairness in Women's Sports Act, requires that schools, quote, designate intercollegiate and interscholastic athletic teams according to the biological sex of the team members, end quote. It defines biological sex as the sex listed on a person's birth certificate at the time of their birth. It also explicitly states that teams designated for females are not open to participation by anyone whose birth certificate said male at birth, which specifically excludes transgender girls and women. The bill will become law August 1st and will apply to public elementary, middle, and high schools, as well as public universities. It will also apply to any private school or university that receives public funds. The bill also gives students and others the ability to sue schools who allow transgender girls and women to play on female sports teams, and prevents action taken against anyone who reports a school who violates the law. Governor Edwards said Monday that there has not been a single instance in Louisiana of a transgender woman requesting to participate on a women's sports team, but that he has allowed the bill to take effect because he anticipates that the legislature would have overridden his veto. The governor added that this is, quote, a solution in search of a problem that simply does not exist in Louisiana, end quote. A North Carolina sheriff's office announced a $3 million settlement on Monday in a lawsuit filed by the family of an unarmed black man who was shot and killed in his car by sheriff's deputies more than a year ago. The family of Andrew Brown Jr. had filed a $30 million civil rights lawsuit in 2021, saying Brown died because officers showed, quote, intentional and reckless disregard of his life, end quote. Brown was killed on April 21st of last year by Pasquotank County Sheriff's deputies while they were serving drug-related warrants at his Elizabeth City home. Several deputies surrounded Brown in his car before the car backed up and moved forward. Officers fired several shots at and into his vehicle. Brown was killed by a bullet to the back of his head. District Attorney Andrew Womble had said at a news conference last year that Brown used his car as a deadly weapon, causing deputies to believe it was necessary to use deadly force. However, lawyers for the Brown family said the shooting was unjustified because Brown was trying to drive away, not toward the deputies, and that he posed no threat. After viewing body camera footage of the shooting, they said Brown was sitting in his stationary car with his hands on the wheel when the first of numerous shots was fired. The $3 million settlement was approved by the Pasquotank County Board of Commissioners. The county's payment resolves potential liability against the defendants and any individual officers who were either named or could be named as defendants in the lawsuit. The family also entered into a stipulation in which it dismisses all claims against the defendants, namely Pasquotank County Sheriff Tommy Wooten and three sheriff's deputies, as well as other potential claims arising from Brown's death. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on local artist Mike Bennett's exhibit, Dinolandia, in downtown Portland. The immersive walkthrough two-story museum features more than 50 species of dinosaurs. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 58 degrees. Tomorrow will again be cloudy with a high of 75 degrees. Today in history, in 1913, Hudson Stuck, an Alaskan missionary, leads the first successful ascent of Denali, formerly known as Mount McKinley, the highest point on the North American continent at more than 20,000 feet. The quote of the day is from American politician and 44th President of the United States, Barack Obama, who said, quote, "Change will not come if we wait for some other person or some other time. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the change that we seek." End quote. The January 6th committee will soon release new details of its investigation. The House will vote on a gun control package, tariffs are suspended on some solar panels, and the Summit of the Americas is underway in Los Angeles. With more on the story, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We are going to tell the story of a conspiracy to overturn the 2020 presidential election and block the transfer of power.
In a conversation with the Washington Post Monday, Representative Jamie Raskin said the January 6th insurrection was a far-reaching conspiracy. The Maryland Democrat is one of nine lawmakers serving on the committee investigating the attack. The committee will hold a primetime hearing Thursday when they will release part of their findings. Raskin says the group will continue unpacking the investigation's results in future televised hearings.
So this is an extraordinary and unprecedented event in our history. I mean, you really have to go back to the Civil War to understand anything like it.
House Democratic leaders are poised to vote on an eight-bill gun control package dubbed the Protecting Our Kids Act. Among other things, the measures would raise the legal age for purchasing assault rifles, set new policies for storing guns in homes with children, and ban high-capacity magazines. Most of the reforms are likely to fail in the evenly split Senate. President Joe Biden is suspending tariffs on solar panels from Southeast Asia in an effort to spur adoption of the clean energy alternative. The New York Times reports the two-year hold is drawing the ire of some domestic manufacturers and labor unions, who worry lifting the tariffs could flood the market with cheap products. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says the president will invoke the Defense Production Act to stabilize domestic production.
Altogether, these historic actions will cut costs for American families, strengthen our power grid, and tackle the climate crisis.
The Summit of the Americas kicked off Monday in Los Angeles. The event includes leaders from most of the countries in the Western Hemisphere, and it's the first time the summit has been held in America since the inaugural event in 1994. There are a few notable absences this week, including Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The Mexican leader is protesting the United States' refusal to extend invitations to Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, all of which have frosty relationships with America. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said Mexico's foreign secretary will attend the summit.
We also note that non-governmental representatives will be in attendance from Cuba, from Venezuela, and from Nicaragua.
And British Prime Minister Boris Johnson narrowly survived a vote of no confidence from his own party yesterday. Tory lawmakers voted 211 to 148 to keep Johnson in power, falling short of the simple majority needed to oust the PM. While Johnson may have survived this threat to his leadership, he's not out of the woods. According to the New York Times, several prime ministers who've survived past votes of no confidence, including Margaret Thatcher and Johnson's predecessor Theresa May, were later brought down by internal party strife. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Cherokee Nation and the U.S. Mint celebrated the release of the Wilma Mankiller Quarter, and Montana tribes will receive the first round of federal funding for water and sewer projects on tribal land later this year. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Cherokee Nation and the U.S. Mint celebrated the release of the Wilma Mankiller Quarter Monday in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. The quarter is one of 5 designs in the American Women Quarters program. The program is highlighting the accomplishments and contributions of trailblazing American women, including in areas of civil rights and government. Mankiller was the first woman elected principal chief of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma. During the event, current principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, Chuck Hoskin Jr., talked about Mankiller's legacy. He says she helped lead the way and work to improve health care, address racial justice, and advocate for women's rights.
If Chief Mankiller's legacy was summed up simply by what she did, my friends, it would be enormous. But her legacy grows because her work continues to make an impact. And I see it every single day. She keeps changing the world every time our tribe helps an elder live in more dignity. She keeps changing the world every time neighbors join together to make their Cherokee community a safer and better place to live. She keeps changing the world every time a kid applies for college or starts learning the Cherokee language.
TV Johnson with the U.S. Mint told the crowd the work they do at the Mint is connecting America through coins. He says the Cherokee Nation has been featured on dollar coins, but not on a quarter.
This will be the first time that a quarter will feature the image of a Cherokee member, a coin that changes hands over and over and over again, prompting anyone who sees it who's not in the know to say, "Who is this?" And perhaps inspire a little girl or even a little boy to become inspired about Wilma Mankiller and her remarkable perseverance that contributed so much to the Cherokee people world and people worldwide.
The coin's design depicts Mankiller looking to the future wrapped in a shawl and the seven pointed stars of the Cherokee Nation. The inscriptions are in English and in the Cherokee syllabary. The release of the Mankiller quarter is the third coin in the program. U.S. Deputy Secretary of Transportation Polly Trautenberg will visit the Cherokee Nation Tuesday. The tribe and federal agency will sign a compact to oversee road construction and transit projects without having to seek federal permission and oversight. They will then tour an electric charging station and take an electric bus to a project. Montana tribes later this year will receive the first round of federal funding for water and sewer projects on tribal land. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the money comes from Congress's bipartisan infrastructure bill passed last year.
Montana tribes will receive just shy of $2 million this year for construction of new wells and lift stations, as well as other improvements for tribal water and sewer systems. Projects on the Crow Agency, Blackfeat, Flathead, Fort Belknap, and Northern Cheyenne reservations will be funded this year. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, tribes across the nation will receive a total of $3.5 billion for water and sewer projects by 2025. Outdated water and sewer infrastructure has hampered the Blackfeat Nation in particular. The tribe has been unable to build a new drug treatment center and other sorely needed services because Browning's water and sewer system is maxed out. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Globally and within the U.S., society is teeming with weapons. According to new data published by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, world military spending has surpassed $2 trillion for the first time in history. The U.S., with just over 4% of the world's population, accounts for nearly 40% of all global military spending. At the same time, domestically, there are about 393 million privately owned firearms in the U.S., or in other words, 120 guns for every 100 Americans. That's the highest rate of any country in the world, and more than double the rate of the next country on the list. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
America is awash with weapons, and the tragic consequences are before us every day. The world is also awash with weapons, as reported by the Stockholm Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, in Sweden, the leading source for data on military spending and the arms trade. SIPRI's latest report shows that the U.S. remains the world's leading arsenal. President Biden, speaking recently about U.S. arms aid to Ukraine, claimed that the U.S. is the arsenal of democracy. I'll come back to that shortly. But first, here are some findings on the global arms situation. As for arms transfers, the U.S. is by far the leading arms exporter at 39% of the world total, followed by Russia and France. China and Germany are a distant fourth and fifth. Europe accounts for 13% of global arms transfers and is the world's major growth region in arms imports. Other regions with significant increases in arms imports are Oceania, especially Australia, and East Asia. The U.S. is the major arms supplier to both Asia and Oceania. Rivalry with China is the principal rationale. The war in Ukraine will add to the U.S. role as the world's leading arms supplier. The latest arms package of about $47 billion to Ukraine makes Kyiv the largest yearly recipient of U.S. military aid of at least the past two decades. The amount is more than twice the largest yearly total ever provided to Afghanistan and about seven times Israel's annual military assistance package. As for military spending, official spending, as reported by governments, shows the United States in the lead, with China, India, the United Kingdom, and Russia following. These five account for 62% of global military spending of about $2.1 trillion in 2021, the first time such spending exceeded $2 trillion. The U.S. accounts for 38% of the world total, spending as much as the next nine countries combined. Total official U.S. spending came to $801 billion in 2021. It will be $853 billion this year. The U.S. military burden, which is to say the percent of GDP, is 3.5% as of last year, three times that of China. U.S. funding for military research and development rose by 24% between 2012 and 2021. Here are some broader implications of these figures. First, the U.S. remains by far the principal military power in world affairs. Its military spending and exports continue to grow, increasingly driven by China's activities, but now also by the war in Ukraine. But we should not forget, as a constant factor, the political power of MAGIC, the military, academic, governmental, industrial complex, particularly in today's new Cold War environment. Second, the slowing of the world economy during the pandemic has only slightly impacted, up or down, global military spending and arms imports. Third, the war in Ukraine is sharply increasing military imports and spending throughout Europe, and there are no prospects for a negotiated end to the war, meaning that there will be ever more sophisticated weapons brought into play. Fourth, an easy prediction. Future SIPRI reports in 2023 and beyond will have similar depressing figures on arms transfers and military budgets. They always grow up. Fifth, let's not be deluded about being the arsenal of democracy. We're an arsenal, period, at home as much as abroad. With more guns in Americans' hands than there are people, roughly 400 million privately owned, with 11 million manufactured in 2020 alone, with mass shootings taking more lives each year, 230 so far this year, way more than in any other country, and with murderous attacks on schools that politicians can't or won't stop, we are a country out of control. Demand for guns has surged since the Trump years, and gun manufacturer profits are at an all-time high. The parallels between U.S. arms policy abroad and its domestic counterpart are inescapable. The powerful combined influence of congressional support for an unregulated gun market, the obeisance of right-wing politicians to the National Rifle Association and pro-gun lobbyists, and the impunity of gun manufacturers when mass shootings occur. Our arsenal may help protect some people abroad, such as the Ukrainians, and we know, of course, that it protects dictators at least as often. But at home, that arsenal is a threat to national security, democracy, and public health. Only by getting rid of at least the automatic weapons do we have any hope of keeping our democracy and our social well-being. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 7th, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Jonah Chester, Antonia Gonzalez, and